This program is a production of the Reformed Forum, an organization devoted to producing and distributing Reformed theological content for a connected age. Online at reformedforum.org. This is Christ the Center, episode number 193. Today we speak about evangelicals and political conservatism. Welcome to Christ the Center, Doctrine for Life, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 193. And my name is Camden Busey. I'm very excited and pleased to welcome back to the program our good friend, Jeffrey C. Waddington, who is teacher of the congregation at Calvary OPC in Ringo's, New Jersey. Welcome back, Jeff. It's great to have you.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, yeah, we're just us two today. We're going to have a fun discussion, discussing some hot topics and so maybe some contentious ones. It's kind of a preview of an interview we'll do down the road. Today we want to speak about Christianity and theology, and particularly American politics and American evangelicalism and the combination between the two. But before we get there, I do need to mention a few things. A big announcement today. For those listening on the podcast, this news will be a little bit out of date, but you may not have heard it, but Reform Forum is now officially a 501c3 tax-exempt organization, which means that the Internal Revenue Service of the United States of America has recognized us as qualifying to receive tax-exempt donations and gifts. So we're very excited. This has been a very long process. We incorporated in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, April 1st, 2010. That was all with the intent of eventually becoming a nonprofit, official nonprofit organization with the federal government. And we've had some wonderful help from our friend Jim Sweet, who's an attorney and who helps out, works for Westminster, but he helped us out pro bono. And so I want to publicly thank him and publicly announce that we are now officially a nonprofit organization with the IRS, so the full-blown deal, and we can now accept tax-exempt donations and gifts. So with that in mind, we do also want to mention, Jeff is loving this segue, but this is no, we kid, but this, of course, is no laughing matter, and we don't make light of it, but the Reform Forum Network, everything we do here is listener-supported, and we greatly need your contributions to be able to continue to produce and distribute all of our programs. We have some great projects coming up in the near future. We want to hit a couple things really hard toward the end of the year. But as we endeavor into some new areas, we also need to maintain that which we already do. And that includes Christ the Center. We want to continue doing Philosophy for Theologians, all the websites, Reformed Media Review. We have a lot of programs that have fallen behind, and that's mainly because we don't have time to do them because we work other jobs. So ideally, we could eventually start to build up a small, modest budget so that we would be able to continue to develop and expand our reach and to provide resources for all ages and for all abilities, not just simply doctoral students at Westminster Seminary, but, you know, ideally down the road, long term, we could have resources for 2 and 3 year olds or
for the whole church.
For the whole church. That's ideal. The whole church, good, solid Reformed theology from the Westminster Standards, but for all ages and all abilities. That's our goal. So if you can help us out, please visit us online at reformedforum.org/donate. Or email us at mail@reformforum.org if you'd like to learn more, or you can call us. Our phone number is on the website as well. And you can talk to us about what we hope to do, what our goals are, what our plans are. And all of this now can be done with a tax exemption. So we want to thank everybody for their support of everything we do at Reformed Forum in this particular program, Christ the Center. All right. Well, today, I already mentioned, we do want to speak about politics, the intersection between the church and the state, religion in the public square, American evangelicalism, all these sorts of things. And what name comes to mind when you hear all these themes in terms of Reformed theologians or historians speaking about these types of issues?
Well, Abraham Kuyper, John Calvin, there's a whole bunch.
What about contemporary authors? I'm throwing you a softball here.
You may be, but given my state of mind.
Well, we have a new book in front of us.
I'm sorry. Yes. our good friend Daryl Hart.
And yeah.
His book.
Now, of course, there are many people writing on the subject of church and state. That's
in fact,
2K theology, all sorts of things.
But Daryl mentions in there, he has somewhere in the book, I forget the chapter, where he has the statistics, I think in a footnote, about the number of books that have come out over the years on that subject of either church and state or evangelicalism.
Well, it's amazing, isn't it?
Political action or social action, the different terminology that's out there. But his new book is called From Billy Graham to Sarah Palin, Evangelical Betrayal.
Evangelicals and the Betrayal.
And the Betrayal of American
Conservatism. Yeah, it's from Erdman's. We don't want to spill the beans too much because we're working on scheduling Dr. Hart for an interview, so we'll get his take on all this. But this will be a primer
It's very
advance on that future interview.
I find it a fascinating book.
Maybe, oh yeah,
because I think I was born a conservative, and becoming a Christian gave me a better foundation for that point of view.
Interesting. And that's partly what Dr. Hart is arguing, first, that evangelicals are really not truly conservative.
Yeah, right. That's the big
or argument. They have taken conservative positions in the past few decades for reasons other than being conservative.
Right.
In the political sense.
Correct.
But yet he also argues at the end of why evangelicals should be politically conservative. And so we can talk about some of those issues, and we can ask Daryl about this when he comes on the program, too.
Now, it's very possible that my own personal reading has delved fairly deeply into political foundations, conservative foundations. So my reading has been out in that field beyond the evangelical interaction.
Sure.
There are criticisms that I would... one criticism in general that I would offer of what I would call secular conservatism is that there's very little notion of what we would call regeneration. Of course, we don't expect it, but the idea of change. There's very much the idea that if you are this way, you're this way for life.
Yeah.
In other words, there's no concept of forgiveness, regeneration, or a change of life or character, which is at the heart of course, of the Christian faith. But so that's an element that while I would read I'm thinking in particular of one, actually a Canadian conservative. There are a few of those. and throughout his
writing, you
have
some family ties to the great country of Canada.
They're not conservative, but that's another ball game. But this one person I'm thinking of, his name is William Gairdner.
Okay.
He's written a fair bit but he does not have the note. It's almost as if you're a crook, you'll always be one. Or if you're on welfare, you'd always be on it. And that does not seem to square with the gospel. That's just one minor difference.
Let's begin just a little bit speaking about the concept of evangelicals. And Daryl Hart has a book called Deconstructing Evangelicalism.
He does.
And I very much agree with his conclusions in the book. I think you do too as well, Jeff,
at least
to some degree.
And I became a Christian and happily embraced the label evangelical. I don't use that term. I don't apply that term to myself anymore, only because the word more, let me put it this way, more obviously is a wax nose. I think it was a wax nose back when I was a young Christian. I just was not aware of how much it was.
Uh-huh.
But now it's become, when you can have an evangelical Catholic, the term kind of has lost its meaning.
That's Dr. Hart's position, not necessarily that there isn't some value in it, or even historically there has been value, but rather that today it is so broad and encompasses so many views of opposing people that would never accept each other into membership, into their communions, right, that it is, for all intents and purposes, useless. But yet the media and news organizations and politicians who use the word often as an umbrella term to cover a whole host of people who typically, at least when there's only two parties, would typically vote one way rather than
that,
another.
Interestingly,
but that's a challenge. That's been contested.
It wasn't that way. We're really talking about a phenomenon that arose with the Reagan Revolution.
Mm.
And that is, as you already noted, is changing again. But as Daryl points out, and is something that I was familiar with, the evangelical movement, if you will, was not always associated with the Republican Party.
Oh, right.
As it typically is by the media. Now, I think the media treats the evangelical church as a voting bloc,
yeah,
for convenience sake.
Right. It's a handle.
But it's no longer the case that you can assume that an evangelical will be either Democratic or Republican. But what I was going to say is probably, I mean, I knew from early on that evangelicalism was an umbrella term that embraced a whole bunch of traditions, but there were some things that were common to all of the traditions.
Yeah.
But Donald Dayton and a couple of, I forget who else, co-edited a book called The Varieties of Evangelicalism back in the early 90s. And that's still a worthwhile book to read if you're wanting to get a sense of the breadth of evangelicalism, if there is such an animal out there anymore.
Mm.
I mean, theoretically, it covers the Lutherans, Reformed, and that would include Presbyterians and Reformed Baptists in that category, Wesleyans, Pentecostals, Anabaptists. And it's after a while you do begin to wonder, okay, what does it mean?
Exactly.
More or less Bible believing.
Especially if Catholics lumped in there, because
right,
before
with the Reagan Revolution you had co-belligerency, right? In other words, an evangelical and a Catholic would disagree with each other vehemently on theological matters, although even that's now questionable.
Yeah. Post 1994.
Right. But you might get together to protest abortion.
Sure.
And what happens is the walls that would have been built up between Protestants and Catholics because of their theological differences, some of those have been scaled or torn down because of co-belligerency. And, of course, that's a problem because the theological issues haven't gone away, with all due respect to Mark Knoll and Carol Nystrom. The Reformation is not over. It may be being ignored, but it's not over.
I think it depends on what church you look at, too. If you're comparing mainline to Catholic,
oh, yes, of
then,
course.
Then you'd say, you know.
But, I mean, the theological issues that have divided.
Yeah, read Danny Olinger's latest, which is in Confident of Better Things.
Yes, right.
He has a great piece in there stressing the importance of.
But because of the Catholic
Reformation
and the evangelical are no longer strangers to one another, but they become friends through co-belligerency, there has been a tendency to water down the theological distinctives.
Mm-hmm. You look like a guy like John Roberts, for instance. Chief Justice, right? And he's a champion to many evangelicals because of his hard stance on and his important emphasis he places on the sanctity of life, even over preborn children, unborn children, and rightly so. Like, yeah, I would. Would I appoint him? Yeah, I would be happy to appoint him. If I was a senator, would I be happy to confirm him? Yes. But it is a little bit ironic because I would imagine many of the theological positions he takes, outside of the courtroom that don't necessarily come directly into the courtroom are vastly different from what a reform person might take, for instance.
And that, of course, that enters into our discussion because many of the authors that I would appreciate who deal with conservative view of politics and culture
Roman Catholic. Exactly.
Now, that's to our shame. What I mean by that is there's a public theology that Roman Catholicism has developed over the years.
You know, I asked...
We are not as good at.
I asked David Skill this. Dr. David Skill is a professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania, a very prestigious school. And we interviewed him quite a while ago, as you're familiar with, Jeff. But for the listeners, you can visit the archives, and we have it, or just search David Skill, S-K-E-E-L, on our website. And I asked him why there was much more of an influence of Roman Catholicism on law than Protestantism, Reformed theology, other than just numbers.
Right.
And it's very possible it's just they've been better at education. They have good, prestigious schools, and they placed an emphasis on education.
I think that's
part of it. Whereas evangelicals, I hate to say it, but there's been this latent anti-intellectualism in many
quarters. And that's a whole part of that. That would, of course, as you would understand, enter into why Roman Catholics have given thought to, I guess you would call it political theology. Public theology is another term, but the interface of the Christian faith.
Yeah. How do our beliefs and our theology impact the way we think government should be run?
Right. And that
we need to have charity there, but I think that's an appropriate thing we can think
of.
And there's been a
history of that, of course, within the Catholic Church.
Oh, very much so.
And of course, it doesn't hurt us to interact with that.
Right.
You know, James Dolezal's been on here talking about learning from Roman Catholic
recovering Thomas,
about
really
simplicity,
right.
Divine simplicity. The same thing could be said. Not we're going to disagree at many points, perhaps. However, as I've said, I'm just trying to think of names. Richard John Neuhaus, of course, when he started writing,
was a big figure,
was a Lutheran. Okay, so in my time as a Christian, he's gone from being a Lutheran to being a Roman. He's passed away now, but gone.
Well,
he
only,
went from
only
being
two
Lutheran
years
to
ago,
Catholic.
You know, the editor of First Things.
Correct.
Many people may be familiar with that.
Author of The Naked Public Square, which is a book that almost everybody has to reference when we're dealing with this topic. Yeah. We've made our reference.
Including,
there you go.
Including Daryl.
And Daryl deals with the book. And there are other authors in the same, you know, that we can learn from the Roman Catholic camp. But getting back to the idea of evangelicalism being a wax nose, because of that closer relationship between Roman Catholics and Protestants, there hasn't been as good a discernment in theological issues as there could be, because people get along.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, I was reading some news reports yesterday, and the meme popped up. Again, for the people listening on the podcast, this is going to be just a few weeks out of date, but a meme popped up about Michelle Bachmann's favorite books and what her influences were. Did you see this?
I did not, but tell me, what are they?
There are a bunch of political books, but in terms of like culture and worldview, two names popped up that were interesting to me, Frances Schaeffer and Nancy Piercy.
Yes, okay, I can understand why those two go together.
Oh, of course, Piercy was a student of Schaeffer.
Right.
But we can get into the theology of those two in a second, but what's interesting to me at this point is the fact that people are very interested, I should say a lot of people are concerned that she would be reading these books. And then, do you think that people are intelligent enough, or that people in the public political square care enough to dig down into influences, or are they simply looking at end result? For instance, when a judge comes up, a Supreme Court justice, I feel like many evangelicals, myself included at times, you look for the boxes that are checked. What's his position on abortion? And if it's on your side, that's good enough. Do we go deep enough, should we ever go deep enough to look at why does such and such a person take that view? Who do they follow in terms of their thought? What kind of intellectual or plausibility structure they're creating for themselves? What sort of things?
You're touching on an issue which is a sore point with me, and that is that America, the United States, as a form of government, is dependent upon an intelligent electorate. Okay, and if we take the approach that you've just described, and we must confess that we all have taken shortcuts, right? it's going to be to our detriment if we vote without thought.
But
taking also, the time.
Also, the problem with our media culture and the shrinking of attention spans and the YouTube debates, we don't have time to understand. We don't, one, don't have access to politicians to ask them real questions. Two, we can't possibly understand in such a short time period why somebody may vote a certain way. We don't get access. Often we're not privileged with access to
all the information.
All the information. Need. Somebody's political philosophy, some thinkers that these people are dependent upon, some reasons why they may vote in one way, which would be more helpful. Because if we understand their reasons, we could probably apply their reasons to unknown situations and understand how they might vote there. But if you think about what happened back in the middle 19th century with Abraham Lincoln and Stephen Douglas.
Stephen Douglas.
I always want to say Frederick, but they're very different people.
Although they were contemporaries.
Yeah, I think Douglas is spelled different. And they
did not agree.
And yes, I think Stephen Douglas was bald and Frederick Douglass had the craziest hair possible. And a beard.
Eventually.
And he was African-American, so that was different. But the Lincoln-Douglas debates were famous. Neil Postman makes a point about these debates and how people used to come and listen attentively for 3 hours.
Eight.
For the introduction.
Yeah, right.
You know,
it could go for one speech could go. I don't know if it was the debate as a whole would go for 8 hours or one of either Lincoln or Douglas. Alan Guelzo has a book on the Lincoln Douglas debates.
Right.
It's fascinating.
But what do you get with those debates? You get the whole context. You get the understanding. Okay, Lincoln, I understand now all he has been reading, why he thinks the way he thinks, these sorts of things. And it's just a richness. And you can make a very informed decision about the person you're voting for.
Right.
When we're sequestered to 1 minute video YouTube clips, it fosters a box checking. Right. And it fosters a visual.
Well, the only way around that is to knowingly buck the trend, swim against the current, whatever upstream.
How do you go about figuring this out? What do you dive down into their advisors? You look at their advisors. How do you even do it?
I think the information probably is out there, but if you're dependent upon others to do the digesting, you may come up short. So you have to be committed to. Yeah, you could start with a Christian voting guide, but don't stop there. You actually have to take time, dig into the history. I mean, we're overwhelmed with information in our age, right? Mm-hmm. Many have said we have a lot of information, but we lack wisdom
and knowledge.
Right?
There's a difference.
And so here we're talking about using wisdom, and that is take the time To answer the complaint, I don't have the time. Well, the truth is we usually find time to do what we want. And so,
well, we're on YouTube to watch the videos. I would imagine that we could cut some YouTube time out.
So if you really think voting from your local all the way up to your national elections are important, then you will take the time to research and find out what the positions are.
Right.
Why the candidates vote a certain way and go from there.
Yeah.
It will take time. And of course, you and I are doctoral students, so we're not sympathetic to the person who thinks they can get away with no research.
Yeah, but we also have trouble relating to reality sometimes.
Well, what is reality? At that point, reality, I'm not going to take the time to learn.
Oh, that's a good
learn
point.
The positions because I don't feel like it.
Yeah.
But I'm going to vote.
Yeah.
I'm actually one of those that I'm not utterly convinced, and if this shocks you folks, so be it. The franchise, should it be universal, that the ability to vote?
Mm.
I'm not convinced that limiting it to landowners was a bad thing.
Or Machen was even interested in simply heads of households.
So, I mean, the point is, it was the assumption was if you were a landowner or head of household, you have responsibility, which has taught you wisdom. That's the idea.
Yeah.
For what it's worth, that's so anybody who just assumes that a universal franchise is better than a limited franchise,
yeah.
In other words, that everybody who's 18 ought to be able to vote. My response to that is, says who?
Yeah. Well, going back to conservatism, I always want to put an extra syllable in there. Conservatism. How would you define that, Jeff? And maybe we can talk about the difference between religious conservatism and political conservatism.
Conservatism, of course, comes from the idea of conserving.
Sure.
Which staying means it's relative.
Resisting change.
It's relative.
Yes. By definition.
I once explained what a U.S. conservative was to my in-laws because they had this idea. And I said, well, technically speaking, an American conservative is actually one who wants to uphold classical liberalism, which, of course, is confusing.
Uh-huh.
But it's true. A conservative in the U.S. is generally, with regard to politics, is generally concerned with upholding the ideas of limited government,
which
enterprise.
Which is tied to low taxes.
Yes. But, I mean, it's the idea that men are not angels.
Mm.
Okay. And there's more. There's obviously a Christian element behind that idea. Men are sinners. Therefore, power ought not to aggregate in one place. And therefore, you have checks and balances. So there's limited government. There's free enterprise. Okay, and there was a third one. It just went right out of my head. But the idea is that the government is not to be a nanny state. In other words, a lot of what we take for granted as being under the purview of government ought not to be done by government. You know, mm-hmm. wealth transfer, redistribution of wealth,
mm-hmm.
Those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
There's more to it than that. That's
well. You mentioned classic liberalism. What was that?
That would be human rights. The idea that God has endowed human beings with certain inalienable rights.
Mm-hmm.
That those are not created by government. They are not given. Because if we say the basic human rights, whatever they might be,
mm-hmm.
if we say that they are given by or created by the government, what does that imply? That they can be taken away by the government. And so if we believe that they are given by God, they cannot be taken away by any government anywhere at any time on the
sure.
face of the earth.
Yeah, I don't think evangelicals are going to disagree on that point. I would be surprised to find some, but perhaps they're out there. But in terms of political conservatism, there's been much more of a shift, especially in this last election with President Obama and many people coming out that are self-identified as evangelicals, but yet voting left rather than right. And there are many reasons for that, but the question I want to ask is the stage properly set for a so-called divorce between evangelicals and conservatives, whereas 10, 20, 30 years ago, we might have thought there was a much closer tie?
Well, let's muddy the waters a little more.
Okay.
There are social conservatives and there are fiscal conservatives.
Yes.
The two often coalesce, but they don't have to.
Exactly.
In other words, the evangelicals are primarily known for being social conservatives. Issues of family, marriage, abortion, homosexuality, these kinds of things. The mm-hmm. fiscal conservatives are obviously those. There is a moral, obviously there's a strong moral element to fiscal responsibility. And of course, that's on the front burner as we are recording this, as recently the debt ceiling was raised
with the trade of
right.
of measures being put into place where it has to be under control in future years.
Right. Anyways,
sorry, I didn't mean suspicious
to provide commentary there, but anyway, so a social a, a a fiscal conservative might not be socially conservative, but they are concerned about being responsible financially.
Right.
And, of course, that's a good character quality to have. But a fiscal conservative is usually one who is committed, in some sense, to limited government. Because, obviously, if you're cutting back on spending...
Yeah, the government has less to work with and has less to spend, less money to employ people with, and less money to do smaller programs government. With. Yeah, so the smaller government.
Generally speaking.
Right. And so, yeah, you're right. There's a distinction between fiscal and social conservatives. So what do you think about the traditional connection between conservatism and evangelicalism? Has that always been the case Carter and Reagan?
No, it's not always been the case, as Daryl has amply illustrated.
Right.
And anybody, you know, I became a Christian in 1983 and have been reading books by Christian scholars who were critical of conservatism. I usually found their arguments to not be persuasive,
mm-hmm.
But they are out there. There has never been a complete convergence of evangelical. Historically, as Daryl points out, their evangelicals were committed prior to the fundamentalist modernist controversy. Evangelicalism was a very activist oriented movement,
mm-hmm.
Whether it be for the abolition of slavery, abstinence from drinking and smoking,
mm-hmm.
and equal rights for women. Just to give you an example of areas where the evangelical movement was involved in the life of the nation beyond the four walls of the church.
Mm.
Especially in the 19th century, the whole idea of a voluntary society, people coming together voluntarily to form an association to further some cause. A lot of that was fueled by the evangelical movement. And that's your 19th century phenomenon. Then comes the fundamentalist modernist controversy and things related to that. For instance, you might understand that the 19th century evangelical social action was fueled in a great way by post-millennial eschatology.
Mm.
And so they were looking to build the kingdom of God on earth through human effort.
Yes.
Obviously, they thought that God was involved in the process.
Yeah, the Spirit was working through them. But
So that was that the hegemony of post-millennial eschatology collapses, and you have the rise of premillennialism. Now, of course, this isn't uniform. Machen being an example of one who was opposed to premillennialism. And so you have the rise of premillennialism and the despair about involvement, Christian involvement in the world. The comparison was often made, you know, between Christian involvement in politics and rearranging the chairs or polishing the brass on the deck of the Titanic. Why bother if the ship is sinking, right? That was the mentality. So for a long time, so you went from evangelical hyperactivity, one could say, to disengagement.
Hmm.
Now that disengagement begins to change in the 60s and 70s. And that change is initially more leftward leaning. As Christians begin to think about being involved in the culture at large, in politics in particular, but then you have the Reagan Revolution and that coming out of the closet of Christians is funneled in the direction of conservative and Republican political causes.
What? How much does someone like Jerry Falwell, a Moral Majority, and all these other organizations, Pat Robertson, that came out with his push for the presidency in the 80s, how much of that is to blame? I don't know. That's the wrong word. How much of that is the reason for that identification with the right?
Well, that would certainly be a part of it, whether it's the cause or the result.
Yeah.
is a good question.
Right.
1976 was declared by Newsweek magazine to be the year of the evangelical.
And that's when
Jimmy Carter
was elected.
A self-professed evangelical, born-again Christian, was elected president.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, and I don't remember this, but Gerald Ford claimed to be a born-again believer, too. I don't remember that being a big deal, but with Carter, it was a big part of his appeal amongst Christians.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that Carter's administration didn't appeal to many Christians, what he actually did once he got into office. And it's in that context that the Moral Majority arises. And according to Daryl's book, Jerry Falwell was originally opposed. Typically, the fundamentalist viewpoint, don't polish the brass on the deck of the Titanic.
Yeah.
But he came to see that politics was controlled by those with whom he disagreed seriously. Mm-hmm. So that's what gave rise to the Moral Majority. But see, the Moral Majority has never been a Christian-only institution. It never was.
Right.
There were Jews and Mormons and others who were involved in that.
So how have things changed, though, since then? We still have groups. We still have right-identified evangelical groups, many of them, people identifying with the right and with social, maybe even fiscal conservatism. But yet there's been a rise in also left-identified groups such as Sojourners. You think of Jim Wallis and others.
Well, of course, they've been around actually since the 60s and 70s.
Right, but how has that developed now to come more into play?
Well, I guess they've been getting a hearing. I mean, my personal assessment is they haven't offered any better arguments, but they've have more influence.
Well, what is the basic gist of that? Why do they choose to identify with the left as evangelicals rather than the right?
Oh, I guess social consciousness. Of course, I'm a diehard conservative, both theologically and politically, so you're not going to get an unbiased assessment of leftward-leaning evangelicals from me.
I think for many there's this social gospel, or at least elements of it. They might not be ingesting all of the theology inherent in that, but
right.
But there's this view of those who suffer, those who hurt, those who are underprivileged, and yet there's an opportunity through government to meet the needs and to have compassion upon many of these people. And so I think a lot in the left desire to have that social consciousness,
right,
that you said.
And that's not a bad thing.
But but to do it through the government, whereas
right.
I
that's
think many
I
conservatives would want to do it nonprofits and other
Richard
ways.
Richard Perard, who is was a professor of history at the University of Indiana, who Dr. Hart mentions in passing.
Yeah.
Dr. Perard has written over the years on various aspects of politics and Christianity. And he just assumes that the government ought to be about social, building a welfare state, to put
sure.
it bluntly. Now, and there are disagreements, and, that even to be a conservative doesn't mean I'll agree with every other conservative on every aspect of how to handle these things, right? The sub-conservatives would say the government has no role whatsoever in helping the disadvantaged.
Mm-hmm.
Others would say there is a role, but it ought to be limited. One of the problems that I have with the more left-leaning approach is, for instance, when they read the book of Acts and they see that everyone had everything in common, they jump to see, well, that's what the government ought to be doing. My response is, you've just shifted from voluntary action induced by the Holy Spirit in the church to compulsory action required by government.
Yeah, the civil government.
That's quite a big leap. But anyway, that's an example of a leap that I don't find acceptable.
Mm.
But there may be a perception out there that conservatives are uncaring. You know, and of course, I don't think that's true.
Well, it's interesting, especially with the George W. Bush, and leading up to it, you had a figure named Marvin Alasky, who wrote a book on compassionate conservatism.
Conservatism, yes.
And then Bush tried to, he incorporated it and tried to implement it. I don't know if Gingrich was involved in this at all. He might have been, but in the intellectual ethos of it. But they tried to recast and try to think through how conservatives might still implement programs and ways to have the government support people to do compassionate
acts. Yes, you're thinking
ministries.
Of faith-based initiatives.
That's where that came from.
Yes,
to my understanding,
the idea was that religion is not anathema to good government.
Right.
In other words, the Constitution forbids the federal government from establishing a religion or preventing the free exercise of religion, but it never said that the federal government had to be antithetical to religion, and therefore. President Bush had the idea of faith-based initiatives. There are problems that I have with that notion because of entanglement with monies and so forth. But the idea, and it was not a popular one outside of religious circles, if you remember. I remember one of the original directors of the Office of Faith-Based Initiatives was a professor from Pennsylvania.
Mm.
DiIulio, I forget. But anyways, and of course, there are some people that would consider that Bush Jr. was not a conservative in the true sense. Except that I just finished reading his book, Decision Points. In many areas, he would be, but perhaps not a, 100%.
And
conservative.
Some people mark 9/11 as a transition point in the way he thought, but
that would change a lot of people.
Yeah,
thinking.
So, from Billy Graham to Sarah Palin, Evangelicals and the Betrayal of American Conservatism. Having not finished the book yet yourself, but what is your assessment to this point?
I think so far he's right on track. I'll be interested to see what he argues at the end, why evangelicals should be concerned, because I already think that, but I'd like to see what he means by that.
Mm-hmm.
But so far it's a very fascinating read, because it's dealing with issues that were part of my pilgrimage as a believer.
Yeah.
It's definitely worth reading. Food for thought. It'll be good to have an interview with him.
Yeah, we will. It is from Erdmann's. It is written at a more popular level, so there's not a whole lot of appeal to church history. And if there is, then he explains it in simple terms. He doesn't just pull names out and expect you to understand what he means. But it's written at a popular level where anyone really interested in evangelicalism and politics could pick it up and get along just fine. So it's a handy book, and we'll have Dr. Hart on. I've already been speaking with him about it. We're debating on whether to have him in studio or do it over Skype. That's the question, because he lives in Michigan now. But it should be good, and it's definitely
worth
a read.
Did we ever settle the question of what he was looking out the window at?
No. There's a picture of, if you look at the back flap, they often have pictures of the author, where they have a picture of Daryl looking out the window with this grin on his face, and we were trying to figure what he was looking at. Somebody, was it Sebastian or was it? It wasn't Glenn. I apologize. Somebody on Facebook suggested he might be trying to spot. I think it might have been me, but just to spot New School Presbyterians.
That's it.
And then who knows what he would do to them. I don't know.
Ooh.
But from Billy Graham to Sarah Palin, Evangelicals and the Betrayal of American Conservatism by Dr. Daryl G. Hart from Erdmans. Available now at WTSbooks.com. Jeff is available in many different places, but you can find him online and find his sermons all over the presbyteries of New Jersey and Pennsylvania, but his Philadelphia, but
in
his
New York.
In New York, but his church home where he's installed as a teacher is calvary-amwell.org, A-M-W-E-L-L, calvary-amwell.org. You can find him there as well as our friend Jim Cassidy. And you can find Jeff on Twitter at RevJW. That stands for Reverend Jeff Waddington, at RevJW, and he tweets there. And feedingonchrist.com, where he posts book reviews and news information about various topics. I'm available on the websites, reformforum.org. You can also find me on Twitter at Camden Busey, and love to interact with people there. So tweet me, and we'll have a back and forth about something, whatever you want. And, you, of course, you can email reformforum@reformedforum.org to get a hold of us there as well. And remember, we're a 501c3 organization now, and we can accept tax-deductible gifts. So please support us today by visiting us online at reformedforum.org/donate. We want to thank everybody for their support. We thank everybody for listening to this episode of Christ the Center.